Chapter 55, East of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The freezing rain that swept down off Lake Erie had been pelting the side of the Pullman Silver Palace car all day. Thomas and Oconee holed up in their small walnut-paneled staterooms until dinner time. Thomas spent his time reading a book on art given to him by McNabb, while Oconee tried to stay warm as he fleshed out the journal notes from the three-day fossil dig on the banks of the Mississippi. The small, pot-bellied wooden stove in the stateroom did not put out enough heat to warm his Hawaiian constitution, and he could not for the life of him understand how anyone would want to live in such a frigid climate. They met in the ornate first-class dining car at 7, and Thomas sighed when the waiter told them that their only choice for dinner was roast beef with potatoes, glazed winter carrots, bread, and barley soup. If they cared for dessert, it would be rice pudding. "December is the cruelest month for a gastronome," he complained to Oconee. "No seafood or fresh pork, few vegetables, no fruit, dry beef. At $4.25 per day, one would think the railroad could put out a better spread." Oconee smiled.
"At home right now, they are feasting on roast suckling pig, grilled ahi tuna, savory rice, pineapple, and greens fresh from the garden. And were the uncivilized ones?"
Their waiter heard the conversation and approached the starch linen and crystal goblet-topped table. They had learned in the past 3 days that Louis had an irreverent sense of humor and was unafraid to take familiarities with the first-class passengers.
"More the pity for that, Colonel," said their waiter. "But I think you will find this will ease the pain considerably."
He lay a bottle of deep red wine across his forearm and lowered it beside the candle in the center of the table.
"Chateau Lafite Rothschild, 1871,
he said with a flourish.
"Is it good?" asked Oconee.
"It's $20, if that means anything,"
the waiter replied. Thomas's eyebrows raised. An average bottle of wine cost $1. A very good bottle might fetch $5. How could a bottle of wine possibly cost as much as a new revolver? Louis read his mind.
"When our wine purveyor recommends a new purchase for the railroad, he is required to open a bottle for the first-class stewards and waiters to taste. The beauty and balance of this wine are phenomenal, my friends. Seamless tannins and fruit, full body, yet so balanced and refined. You will note hints of sweet tobacco and berries and minerals and cedar. It is a beautiful wine with superb depth. But if you choose not to purchase this wine, gentlemen, I will have to sit in on the poker game that is warming up next door in the smoking car and do my best to earn enough to buy it myself."
Oconee looked at Thomas with an expression that said, "Why not?" Thomas smiled and shook his head. This waiter would be fired for such impertinence at Delmonico's, but somehow, out here in the frigid darkness of Pennsylvania, his attitude lifted Thomas's spirits.
"Did I mention that the magic of this wine will also hide the taste of what is about to come out of the kitchen?"
said Louis. "Uncork it," said Thomas. "Let us see." A moment later, Louis had Oconee's and Thomas's glasses filled halfway. "You didn't do that quite right," said Thomas as he inhaled the complex aromas of the deep red wine. A worried look crept across the waiter's face.
"Sir?"
Thomas slid an empty glass across the table. "I want you to join us." The very surprised waiter looked around the car to see if anyone was paying attention, but the other diners were engrossed in their own conversations, and so he happily poured a glass for himself. The three men tapped their stemware together in a quiet toast and took their first tastes. Thomas was a relatively new onophile, but he was a fast learner who took every opportunity to explore new wine varieties and vintages wherever he traveled. The instant the Lafitte made contact with his taste buds, he looked into Acconi's eyes and saw that his friend, while admittedly no wine connoisseur, was experiencing the same emotions that were overwhelming his own sense of smell and taste. The waiter set down his empty glass.
"Well?"
he asked. Acconi spoke first.
"I have no idea what you are talking about, with the tannin and tobacco chatter, but I am pretty sure this is the finest wine I have ever tasted."
"Extraordinary," Thomas said in a hushed voice. Acconi gave him a perplexed look. Thomas was not given to hushed tones about any topic he was passionate about, especially not great food or wine. When the Hawaiian realized his friend was not thinking about the wine at all, the real effect of the remarkable vintage on Thomas had been to make him equate the perfection he was experiencing with the wife he was longing for. In fact, what Acconi saw in Thomas's eyes was pure guilt. The waiter was also taken aback by the colonel's change in temperament. He started to turn to go to another table when Acconi said,
"Do you have more?"
"Of the wine, sir?"
"Yes. We'd like another bottle."
Thomas managed a strained smile. He knew what Acconi was doing.
"We have more, sir, a full case, I believe,"
the waiter said.
"I did mention that it is..."
$20, yes you did,"
Acconi replied. He pulled his wallet from his breast pocket and withdrew two crisp $20 bills.
"In case the meal you are about to serve kills us before we settle up," he said.
The waiter grinned and left to fetch another bottle of the Lafitte Rothschild. "And so now drink is the solution to melancholy?" Thomas asked. "And here I had always believed that it only deepened the condition."
"Melancholy you may become. Ho aloha. But after two bottles of this wine, it will be quite a satisfactory kind of unhappiness. You'll see."
Thomas couldn't help but smile. Acconi's use of the affectionate variation of the Hawaiian word for friend touched him. He raised his goblet. "To a pleasant melancholy," he said, and they drained their glasses. The eastbound train cut through the rain and sleet, sheeting across the Allegheny Plateau, slowing a bit as they reached the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains west of Johnstown, where the locomotive would make an early morning fueling stop and allow passengers who wished to disembark for a couple of hours to stretch their legs and perhaps enjoy a meal at a nearby hotel. The last leg of the journey to New York City was just over 300 miles, which would see the train arrive late tomorrow evening. Thomas and Acconi pushed away from the table and walked down the narrow aisle of the lamp-lit dining room towards the rear door of the car. It was fortunate that the first-class car was only about a third full, because Acconi had to turn sideways and shuffle down the aisle, apologizing to the people at each table he squeezed past. They slid open the connecting door to the smoking car and walked into a haze of cigar smoke and animated conversation. This car was full, and Thomas felt the familiar tug of the game tables. But there was still a lot of work to do before he retired for the night. They reached the back of the smoking car and opened the door to the next cabin, which turned out to be a completely empty standard fare coach. The porters were keeping the wood stove going, but without the usual 40 or 50 bodies inside to help contribute to the heat, the space was so cold that they could see their breath. Thomas was about to make a joke about the freezing morning in Ohio when he was a child and had been told to milk their cow, only to discover that her teat was covered in ice, when the compartment door at the end of the car slid open, and he found himself just 20 feet from A'ata, who was surging into the car with five Tahitian warriors in ill-fitting suits behind him. Thomas froze, and then felt Acconi's hand on his shoulder.
"What is this?"
the Hawaiian whispered. Thomas reached inside his jacket for his pocket revolver, and he knew without checking that Akoni was drawing his weapon. A'ata came to a halt 5 feet in front of Thomas, raised his hand for his men to also stop.
"I have traveled a long distance to find you,"
A'ata began in halting English.
"And now you have," replied Thomas in French.
The Tahitian seemed relieved that he did not have to continue in an unfamiliar language. His eyes bored into Thomas, and his hand gripped the handle of the knife in his waistband. The warriors bunched up behind him, looked tense, ready to spring. After a moment of silence, Akoni spoke.
"What do you want, brother?"
A'ata ignored the fact that he had just been addressed as a kinsman by this great oaf, simply because they both came from the same far-distant corner of the globe.
"You should ask me that question,"
said a familiar voice from behind the crush of Tahitians. Thomas and Akoni were astonished to see Fitch Donegan push his way through the warriors and stand beside A'ata. The look of triumph in the assassin's eyes told Thomas that his sudden appearance had had exactly the reaction he had hoped for. A'ata began to take a step forward, but Donegan placed a hand on the warrior's forearm.
"I'm giving you 2 minutes," Donegan said to A'ata, "and then I'll do the job I've come here for."
"You both work for Colin Stafford?" Thomas asked. This was beyond belief. Donegan chuckled.
"Relatively speaking, Colonel, and I must emphasize the relative part."
"What is your game, Donegan?"
asked Akoni.
"No game," Donegan replied. "Just a quiet powwow between two men who work for a pair of, let's say, unusual brothers."
Thomas kept his hand on his revolver butt.
"Brothers, what the hell does that mean?"
"It means, my dear Colonel Scoundrel, that the entire Stafford clan is out for your hide, though my friend A'ata has been also charged with a little extra work on the side before that particular job gets done."
"The entire clan? Brothers?"
A light of realization began to spark in Thomas's eyes.
"Colin Stafford is Wallace's brother," he said in a tone devoid of emotion.
"Bravo, Colonel," said Donegan with a smile. "The Hawaiian banker and the San Francisco businessman. As unlike in physical appearance as the two men could be, all they share in common is a ruthless appreciation for money and the desire and ability to get rid of anyone who stands in their way."
"Brothers,"
mumbled Akoni. No one had ever breathed a word of this possibility at the court of the Hawaiian king, or in social gatherings or business meetings. It was a staggering thought.
"One dark, one fair, both committed to turning out the good colonel's lights forever," Donegan continued.
The train clattered onto a long trestle, and the gas lamps on the walls flickered off and on for a moment. One of the warriors behind A'ata said something in Tahitian, and A'ata snapped his fingers for silence.
"I'll ask you once more, Donegan. What do you want?"
asked Akoni.
"My wants are few," Donegan replied. "I've been paid to find Colonel Scoundrel and deliver justice for the unwarranted attacks he made on Colin Stafford in that pissant newspaper he works for. His slander caused pain and humiliation and loss of revenue, and Stafford will have his revenge tonight."
Akoni had pulled his revolver completely out of his waistband now. "Shoot Donegan and A'ata first," he calculated, "and the other 5 will scatter." Donegan extracted a toothpick from his vest pocket and picked at his front teeth.
"Terrible roast beef tonight, wouldn't you agree?"
Neither Thomas nor Akoni answered.
"And now, A'ata, get to your business," Donegan said. 2 minutes, no more."
A'ata put one hand on the corner of a bench seat to steady himself as the train went into a long curve.
"You owe Wallace Stafford's bank $50,000, he said to Thomas. "Pay it tonight, and I will leave you."
Thomas turned to look at Akoni.
But he won't,
said the Hawaiian, nodding towards Donegan.
Donegan's business with you is no concern to me, or to Wallace Stafford. I am instructed to collect the money and return to Honolulu. What happens afterwards?
He spat on the floor.
I do not care. If it were my choice, I would kill the bastard this minute and be done with it.
Didn't care for the army boy marching between your girl's legs, eh? Laughed Donegan. A'ata did not take the bait. He kept his gaze fixed on Thomas's face and pistol hand.
Pay now, he said, and we are through.
Thomas looked around the car. The warriors with A'ata were itching to fight, and Donegan was holding a long knife, flat against his leg. Even with their pistols, he and Akoni would be lucky to kill two or three of the men before they were overwhelmed.
I don't have the money, A'ata, said Thomas. In fact, I'm on my way to get it in New York City. From there, I will take it directly to your boss, and as you say, we will be done.
A'ata sensed that the colonel was telling the truth.
Then I will come with you to New York, and I will wait while you gather the money. Then I will travel at your side to Hawaii and watch you pay your debt in full.
Donegan chuckled.
That's your plan?
The hand holding the knife began to raise up from his side.
I have another.
Thomas stepped back and prepared to shoot. Then Akoni let out a great cry, leaned over to the wall of the compartment, and ripped a heavy brass lamp from its mooring. He flung it at A'ata, striking him in the chest and knocking him backwards into his men. All six Tahitians were shoved back in the narrow corridor between the seat rows by the momentum of the lamp and A'ata, and Donegan got caught up in the avalanche of bodies and was briefly knocked off his feet. The respite was brief. A'ata and the rest of his men leapt to their feet and rushed forward in single file between the seats. Just as he pulled the trigger of his revolver, Thomas was momentarily surprised to see Donegan slink to the back of the car, only to realize that the assassin was making a strategic retreat. He would let Thomas and Akoni tire themselves fighting A'ata and his men, and only come to fight if the Tahitians could not get the job done themselves. His contract called for scoundrel dead, and at that moment, he didn't care how the job got done. The sound of Thomas's pistol was deafening in the enclosed space. His shot missed A'ata, caught the man directly behind him in the shoulder, and sent him reeling to the floor. Before he could fire again, A'ata and another man were on him, punching and clawing and hammering with their fists. Out of the corner of his eye, Thomas saw three of A'ata's warriors climbing over seat backs to get to Akoni, and a moment later, his friend was smothered beneath a pile of thrashing bodies. Thomas kept his elbows close to his body and began to punch methodically at A'ata and the man behind him. He caught A'ata once on the chin and landed a solid blow on the other man's jaw. But the Tahitians got their blows in, too. Thomas felt the air escape from his stomach, and a pain like a bee stinging slash across his forehead. He grabbed the front of A'ata's shirt with both hands and smashed his head into A'ata's with all his strength. A'ata fell back against a seat, which knocked down the man fighting alongside him. Thomas looked quickly behind him, where Akoni was punching and wrestling three of the warriors. The great Hawaiian tossed one of the men like a rag doll across the compartment, only to be swarmed again and pushed to the floor. Thomas aimed and fired into the coil of arms and legs flailing around on the floor, hitting one of the Tahitians right behind his knee. The man rolled to the side, shrieking in pain. Now it was just two against one, odds that Thomas knew would be in his friend's favor. A'ata and the warrior, fighting beside him, had gotten back up and they came towards Thomas, and then suddenly stopped. A'ata wiped blood from his mouth with his sleeve and fought to catch his breath.
Enough, he yelled to his men. We must remember why we came here.
Thomas kept the pistol aimed at A'ata's chest, until Occonee threw off the two men he had been grappling with and got to his feet. The Hawaiian was bleeding from a cut above his eyebrow, but other than that, he appeared to be in one piece.
"We will return to our cabin," said A'ata between gasps of breath. "I will follow you to the city tomorrow, and you will give me the bank's money as soon as you collect it. After that..."
His voice trailed off. After that what? Thomas wondered as he reholstered his gun. The car smelled of gunpowder and sweat, and a deep cold seeped in from the Pennsylvania countryside and enveloped the exhausted combatants. A'ata and his men took seats on the velvet-cushioned benches, not sure what to do now. Thomas was getting ready to reply to A'ata when Fitch Donegan walked swiftly towards them from the back of the car with a revolver pointed at Thomas's head.
"Put it down!"
Donegan barked at Occonee, who had pulled his own revolver.
"I will not miss his head from this distance."
Occonee slipped his gun back into his waistband and stood still with his arms at his side. "What about Wallace Stafford's order to A'ata to collect the money?" asked Thomas. "I assume Colin was going along with them to mollify his brother, and you agreed?" Donegan grinned.
"Now ain't you the funny one, Colonel? From the rumors I've heard, you disobeyed a direct command from a superior officer during the war, and charged up some damn fool hill and took on a swarm of Confederates all by yourself. Got lucky that day, by God, but you did. So don't preach to me about following orders."
He drew back the hammer of his revolver with his thumb.
"I was ordered to kill you, Colonel, and that's..."
Two things happened in the blink of an eye. Thomas felt, rather than saw, Occonee leap forward towards Donegan, and at the same instant he caught a blur of motion coming up behind the Irishman. Then a brass tube flashed in the candlelight, arced downwards and smashed Donegan's skull. He dropped his revolver, toppled forward, and lay still. Occonee rammed into the corner of a seat, and he, A'ata, the warriors, and Thomas craned their necks to see who had wielded the fire hydrant with such deadly precision. Thomas and Occonee were too stunned to speak. They could only stare, their mouths agape. Standing over Donegan's prostrate form, wearing a man's trousers, cap, and jacket, was 14-year-old Tiana, whom they had left for safekeeping with John Hayden in San Pedro 10 days earlier.